Here at the Patriarchy Podcast, we've been effing on the blam blam as long as I can remember. Now, you don't know what that is? Well, join me today as I interview Army Chaplain B.J. Newman. We're going to get to the bottom of it as we build, fight, protect, and lead. This is the Patriarchy.
Rise up, O men of God. Have done with lesser.
Rise up, O men of God. Have done with lesser things. Give heart and mind and soul and strength and serve the King of Kings. Lift high the cross of Christ. Tread where he has been and have trod. Brothers of the Son of Man, rise up, O men of God.
Do not fret because of evildoers. Be not envious towards wrongdoers, for they will wither quickly like the grass and fade like the green herb. Trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in the land and cultivate faithfulness. That was Psalm 31, verses 1 through 3. I am Pastor Joseph Spurgeon, and you are listening to the Patriarchy Podcast, Ministry of Sovereign King Church. I want to read to you one more verse as we begin today. This comes from 1 Samuel chapter 16. It's verse 1. It says, "Now the Lord said to Samuel, how long will you grieve over Saul, since I have rejected him from being king over Israel? Fill your horn with oil and go. I will send you to Jesse the Bethlehemite, for I have selected a king for myself among his sons." Now, there's no real knowing how long it had been between this chapter and the previous chapter. The previous chapter, Saul had sinned against God. He had not killed the Amalekites all the way that he should, and God removed the kingdom away from Saul. And it was a great grief to Samuel to see Saul, this king of God's people, reject God, refuse to repent of his sins, make excuses, and to be himself rejected by God. And so it's been a few years since Samuel last interacted with Saul. And we know that they departed from each other at the end of the previous chapter, and they actually live just 10 miles apart. And in the previous chapter, at the very end, it said that Saul never saw Samuel until the end of his life. And so you can imagine how grievous this is. Like, they're only 10 miles apart. They don't see each other. And Samuel has been grieving over Saul. And God comes to him and says, "How long will you grieve over Saul, since I have rejected him from being king over Israel? You got work to do, Samuel. I'm going to send you to go anoint someone else. I'm going to have a king that I select for myself," is what God is saying. You know, the godly man does grieve over the sins of those around him. It grieves him when those who are supposed to lead God's people, for example, fall into sin. Like, if you hear about a pastor, maybe he's been faithful, and now he falls into sin, and then he begins to reject the truths of God's word, it is a great grief. It's a grief when we hear about friends that we once thought were faithful, and they slowly grow cold to the truth. It's a grief when any professing Christian turns his back on the truth. It ought to grieve us when we see our nation turn its back on God. Isn't that a grief? Our sin grieves God, and it was a grief to Samuel. But, and there's always a but here, there's actually an inordinate amount of time to be spent grieving. God would not have us give ourselves to grief. We are meant to live in joy, and we're meant to live faithfully. We're meant to live faithfully, even in places where there's a lot of wickedness. Samuel was not permitted to continue dwelling on regrets over the failure of Saul. God was in control. So it was time for him to do something else. Stop your grieving, God is saying. You've spent enough time on it already. I have work for you. Now, we need to be those who grieve over sin and the sin of others. We grieve over those who apostatize and those who don't follow the Lord. Right? We look around at the parading of sodomy in our streets, the excusing of abortion. You know, even since Roe v. Wade has been overturned, which is a great thing, our nation keeps voting for itself to slaughter little children, even so-called red states, conservative places. It is a grief, right? It ought to make us angry, the way that feminism has captured the culture and that young men are harmed and young women harmed by this. You know, I've been grieving for our country for a long time now. I was thinking about this the other day, probably at least 4 years deep grief since COVID and the 2020 election. Again, very disheartened to see how much the wicked seem to have thrived. The psalm writer said that when he looked around at the wicked, his foot almost slipped. He almost fell into their evil and thought, well, if they can get by with it and God's never going to do anything, well, and that's how tempting it is. It is tempting to just become so angry and bitter and criticism, groaning, mumbling. And if we're not careful, and if we're honest, that grief can prevent us from being faithfully engaged. It can lead us to withdrawal, thinking, well, if the whole world's going to hell, well, to hell with the world. At least I'm not corrupted. You know, the whole world's corrupted. Everybody else is. So I'm not going to trust anybody else, right? I can't even trust my fellow Christians. The only person I know I can trust 100% is myself. Maybe my family. This is foolish, right? The heart is deceitful and wicked. Who can understand it? Yet what happens is we grow bitter. We grow angry. And then maybe we give ourselves to just grumbling and complaining. And we start attacking even our brothers and sisters in the faith on areas where they disagree on different issues. And we always think everyone else is just not as pure as ourselves. We think too highly. Everyone else is irredeemably corrupt. But then we go cold to everyone else around us, the people in our family, the people in our church, the people in our town, whatever ville that you live in. I live in Jeffersonville, Clarksville area, Louisville. Whatever ville you live in, you'll grow cold, right? You'll go to the store and you'll be out in public, but it's just something you have to do. There's no love for the people. Your interactions become purely transactional. You don't see people as people made in the image of God. It's just, let me get on with myself. But we are called to love others. We're called to make disciples. And how can we make disciples of Christ? And how can we even be disciples of Christ if our grief, our stress, our anger at the world leaves us without love for others? Right, we should care for those stumbling into sin. We should have pity on them and speak the gospel. We can do good to others. But we can be so bitter in our grief that we have no love, right? We see the homeless man down on the street. We see people stumbling into sin. It's going to destroy them. And here's what we end up thinking. Oh no, here's another person to come corrupting things for me. And we see this a lot online. Young men get very bitter, very angry. And I'm not saying that it's wrong to be angry at sin and these things, but the scripture teaches us that we can't live in that anger, that we have to be faithful. We've got work to do. And if you look around, it seems like there's work that could be done everywhere. And that's another thing this anger and bitterness does. It tempts us to be distracted, from actual genuine work, to spend all our time in petty arguments and debates online. So I have a friend named BJ Newman. He's a army chaplain, and he has a lot of good posts that I keep seeing on social media that have been very encouraging during this time, encouraging me. And one of them was a reminder that we've got work to do and we've got to focus our energy, our attention, where it actually matters. Where it actually matters. And so I read this post of his last week, and it hit me. I don't know, it hit me in a fresh way. Not because any of the truths that he's saying are things I don't know about or hadn't already believed, but it was good to be reminded that we have work where we can be faithful and effective. And so rather than kind of just redrawing and holding up in like a hillside bunker somewhere, or being someone that's running ragged everywhere, spreading themselves in places that doesn't really matter. Scripture says the fool has his eyes to the ends of the earth. And I think many young men, they spend all their time talking political issues and things that they have no influence over, right? All their time is fighting and dividing over political issues and I'm not saying politics don't matter. Actually, they do quite a bit. But they're always dividing over these type of issues. And they're always debating the minutia of things that even at the end of their debate, nothing has actually happened. But BJ Newman's post is helpful. I want to read it to you. And then I'm going to invite him onto the show. And we're going to talk through this post and have him give us some more in-depth. And I think this will be helpful to you. This is what he says. One principle that guides my work in ministry is focusing my energy where I can have the strongest effect. I feel no impulse to spend too much time on issues where the spiritual return is minimal. This leads me to these basic convictions. Number one, family first. The impact I have on my family will be stronger and more lasting than anything else I do, period. Right, God has placed us in a family, and we ought to serve and be faithful there. Number two, local focus. When you have to look at people, live with them, see them at the grocery store, it's harder to create a mythical persona, but the influence is much stronger. I personally would add here, beginning with the church, your local connection with the people in your church is so important. That's where you're going to make a lasting impact. I liked what he said there about the store. You know, I my family was all sick last week, so I had to keep making trips to the pharmacist, and we go to the pharmacy at a big box store. Anyways, while I was there, I think on the third trip, I go up, and the lady's like, I told her I needed to get a prescription for myself, and she's, I know your name, and she put it in. And I was like, it shook me a little bit in a good way of like, here is somebody that knows my name here in this community. I think we're again, tempting to go to the store. We just see people as kind of things for transactions, or they are pawns to be used at best. Otherwise, they're things that get in our way. And it kind of just snapped me out of that. And here's a real genuine person. And these are people around me that I actually can have an influence on. Number three, he says, institutions over popularity. Seeking popularity is a common human temptation, but building something that lasts well beyond your lifetime will do more for the kingdom of God than a large following that dissipates when you grow old or pass away. Number four, fight today's battles. I love reading old books and learning about history. It's crucial to understanding our world and why I believe what I believe. But this can become a way of avoiding what matters today. Instead, I spend my time teaching about what people are encountering in our world. And number five, fundamentals first. I would much rather help people build strong marriages and families or clean up their finances according to biblical principles than convince them of some of my views of some esoteric theological topic. Many churches spend tons of energy on topics that help people gain knowledge while their personal lives are a disaster. He says, by God's grace, I want to help grow the kingdom. How we spend our time, energy, and money is crucial to this task. So again, I thought this post was very helpful. reminding us to put our time and our energy into things where we have an impact. God expects us to have an impact, to be salt and light. He expects that of us. And I think we're tempted to be so angry, so bitter, so grieving over what happens in our culture, what happens in even in a broader church, that we forget we actually have work to do. And so we can spend all of our time on things that don't matter, in arguments about things we have no influence on, or we can hole ourselves up somewhere and I think it's just going to be me and maybe my family out in the woods somewhere, and we're just going to hold ourselves off from the world. And this post, while it does have a focus on localism and our family, it's not the hole up and be a prepper, nor is it waste your time in endless debates over small matters that don't work, that aren't practical, that have no outworking for us. Well, I'm going to have him come on the show now. I think you're going to enjoy our interview. This was very helpful, very encouraging to me, and I hope this will be encouraging to you. Welcome back to the Patriarchy Podcast. I am here with my guest, BJ Newman. BJ Newman is an Air Force chaplain and an ordained Presbyterian minister. He was a local church pastor for several years, and he's presently involved in the work of church planting. Prior to ministry, BJ worked as an intelligence analyst and translator for the Air Force and a high school English teacher. He lives in Xenia, Ohio. Is that how you say that?
It okay. is.
With his wife and four children, where he enjoys hunting, fishing, coaching baseball, and reading old books. Man, is there anything else you don't do?
Yes, I am plenty busy with that project, and that's more than enough to keep me occupied.
All right. Well, welcome to the Patriarchy Podcast. Good to have you here.
Thanks for the invitation, brother.
Hey, I wanted to have you on because, well, I came up and spoke at an event, and we met there, and I was and encouraged by your talk at that event. This was back when was that?
I think
back
it was
fall time.
Yeah, it was back in October, I think, and it was in a local church here, Wilmington Reformed Church. It's an OPC church, and I'm friends with the pastor there, Matt Joyner.
Yeah, and it was a men's event. In fact, Matt Joyner came on the show before, and we talked about his background from Eastern Orthodoxy and how he became Reformed. But so we had a men's event there, and since then I've been paying attention to your Facebook posts or your social media stuff, and recently you had a very good post that was going on with something I've been thinking about is how can we be effective men? You know, there are lots of debates going on right now. And so maybe before we even get to the main topic, let me just ask you this question. I asked you before off air, but I'll ask you now. So are you down with effing on the blim blam?
I am always down with effing on the blim blam, brother. That's my weekend project is effing on the blim blam. Joseph, I got to be honest with you, man. I saw that pop up and I was like, I have no idea what's going on. So I texted a few folks who I thought might know, and they were like, I don't know, something about Doug Wilson. And I was like, oh boy. Okay. So I have no idea. And I spent probably about 30 minutes trying to figure this out. And then I went, you know what? This is not worth my time. I don't care.
Exactly. From what I gather, it's there was this back and forth about Jews and stuff going on with that. And that's been this huge debate going on in social media, different people on the right, people that I agree with on a lot of issues. And yet there's this debate over Jews. Obviously, there's the larger debate in the church over dispensationalism, those things. But Doug Wilson has kind of got himself in the crosshairs with that. And so we had this little article, and I think he was trying to mock the people that were going too hard at the Jews. And yet nobody knows what the effing on the blim blam he means about it. And I've seen all these memes about it. And I bring it up because what's your take on this? Here we go. You're an Air Force chaplain. We'll get you right off the bat, right? What's your take on the Jewish question and and what's going on with all that and that kind of thing.
Yes, this is I think bait to get me canceled is what this is, Brother Joseph. So I guess I'll say it this way, just in keeping with the theme of the podcast. If you came to me and asked me, what is my opinion on dispensationalism? I have a very well thought out, you know, take. I'm a Westminster Presbyterian, so I'm not a dispensationalist. If you ask me what I think about Israel's current invasion of Gaza, I'm, you know, regularly getting, you know, monthly updates with a, you know, classification level above, you know, the norm. And so I'm hearing a lot about it from an intelligence and a foreign policy standpoint. And so if you ask me what my opinion is, I have one. But here's my whole thinking about when I see stuff like that pop up on social media is I have 24 hours in a day and I have only so much bandwidth in my head. And I have to ask myself, what is the return on investment if I take the time to pick up this? Do I think it's wrong to talk about stuff like this? No, I don't. I mean, I think it grows us as men to engage in ideas. And I think the clash back and forth is really helpful for fine-tuning things. You know, I'll give one example. Because this discussion of, you know, Doug Wilson's, I think, published a book and a documentary, and that's why everybody's talking about it, came up. You know, I decided I was going to do a little bit more digging on there's a question within Reformed theology about whether or not Paul's language in Romans 11 means that there's the hope of a sort of revival or return of the Jewish people sort of as a whole back into the olive branch. And so I just decided, you know, hey, I want to, you know, sharpen up a little bit on that. And I listened to a discussion that he had done back in No Quarter November. So I can't remember exactly when it all was, but Pastor Andrew Isker was on there. And he said that he took a preterist view of Romans 11. And I was like, I've never heard of this before. So, okay, why do I bring that up? Because there is a place for us to sharpen our thinking. And so now I'm gonna think about that. I'm gonna investigate that a little bit. But in the big picture of things, I'm a chaplain in the Ohio Guard. I am in the process of working on a church plant here locally. I'm working with East River Church and Pastor Michael Foster. I have a family and I have things that I need to do that in the end I judge to be more important for my time, for my brain space. So I think that's kind of the posture that I take with some of these questions is as I start seeing it, you know, I do think these discussions are important. I do think it grows us intellectually and it grows us in terms of our masculine ability to think and to debate by engaging in some of these places. But at the end of the day, I've got only so much time and so much brain space, and I want to put it where it matters most. And so that makes me want to contextualize things. How many people do I minister to in my National Guard wing even have a clue that this discussion is happening? Very, very few. How many people in my church plant have any like desire to engage this discussion? Probably none of them. And so I have to ask myself, is it really worth my time? And more often than not, as I get older, maybe I'm just getting grumpier as I get older, my answer is no, I don't care much anymore.
Well, that's what's helpful here, man, is I think social media stirs us up with the flavor of the week, the outrage. It's like a 1984 with the seconds of hate, whatever, I can't remember how many seconds it was, or the minute of hate that you had to do. And it's always something every week. And it's very easy for, I think, men to get sidetracked. I don't see a whole lot of women, at least, they get sidetracked in the other things. There's other things that distract from their work, but they're not debating. I've never heard women sit around debating the Jewish question or something like that, right? It's not.
If you've ever found the neck of the internet called the mommy blogs, you know that it happens on the female side as well.
Yeah, on different issues. Yes. They're just not as autistic, maybe, as it's more like. It's more about the essential oils and stuff like that. But so I agree that these things can be helpful. There's nothing forbidden with having discussions, though Scripture tells us to be careful of endless strife, you know, Titus 3:9, but avoid foolish controversies, genealogies, and strife, disputes about the law, for they're unprofitable and worthless. And one of the things I think that God's growing me in, and it sounds like working with you, is I want to be profitable. I want to be found to be a profitable servant. So that's transition. That's, we're done talking about the Jewish question and flim flams and all that stuff. Hello, I'm Pastor Joseph Spurgeon, and welcome to Sovereign King Church. Here at Sovereign King Church, we exist because our King Jesus Christ has called us out of darkness into the light. When we were sinners, struggling, unable to fend for ourselves against our enemies, God sent His Son and rescued us. And so we exist because of Jesus. Jesus is the Sovereign King. We exist to confess that Jesus Christ is King. And we are going to proclaim that Jesus Christ is King to all the world. And therefore, we're going to also build our lives, construct our lives on what Christ has done for us, and construct our lives on the commands of our King.
Wherever you're at in your spiritual journey, there's a place here for you. You don't have to agree with all of the things that we preach here. So wherever you're at and how you know God and who you know Him to be as the Scriptures command, there's a place for you here, because we're all going to get from one level of glory to the next. All of us started out from a, you know, bare bones foundation, and we've grown. There's a place for you to serve in Sovereign King Church.
Your post really, I thought, condensed down very succinctly where it is good to be focused. Where can a man today be focused and actually make an impact? Because if we all agree around us, the world's going crazy here. It's another thing for us to know what to do, how to make an impact. So you've kind of gave the big principle there, which is determine your highest priority and execute, right? So you then said in your post, I don't know if people have seen it, I'll maybe put it in the show notes, this led you to some basic convictions. So let's move more specific application now. Focus where you can actually make an impact, where you get your return. Walk me through then your principles thinking through that. What are those?
Sure. Yeah. So I think, So if folks want to just look it up, it's on Facebook. But I'll just walk through them first step. You know, as I was looking at my priorities, I just decided, this took me about 14 seconds to think through, family is going to be first. And there's a couple reasons for this. One, I have to spend more time with these people, and I love them more than everybody else. And the fact of the matter is, this is just what I want to do. And it's a good and godly thing to do. I just know that whenever you look at where your time is going to be spent, because you live with these people, because you provide for them, because you spend most of your waking life with them, these are the people that you're going to impact the most. But I think it goes a little bit deeper than just simply time. Time is one of the reasons we have this impact, but our family focus allows us to have a generational impact. You know, whenever I start thinking about my calling as a minister, both as a chaplain and as a local church pastor or church planter, one of the things that St. Paul says is that if a man can't lead his family, how can he possibly lead God's church? It's just a logical progression that says this is the proving ground for men who are going to be in leadership. And so I think one of the things that I just decided right out of the gate was, I love these people more, and it's good and godly for me to love my family more. It is a prerequisite for me to be doing the kind of work that I'm doing. And so it makes perfect sense for me to spend my time and energy there. How could I possibly go and minister to my church knowing that my family is suffering or hurting? How can I claim to be a man of God if I know that my children are not being taught the faith. It's just a matter of simple priority. These guys in my home are the most important people to me, but they're also by design the people who are going to have the most impact into the future. And I just think to myself, I want to be like Jonathan Edwards. I don't know if you've ever seen this, brother, but it's all over the internet, so you can look it up. The list of accomplishments that Jonathan Edwards' descendants, I think down to like his great grandkids, is just incredible. It's just amazing. And one of the reasons he was able to do that, obviously there were personal factors, right? He was just a giant of an intellect and he worked like a maniac. But part of it was because he spent an hour every evening that he was home with his family, reading the Bible, praying with his family, teaching them. And I wanted to, in some ways, emulate that as a just as a pattern in my life. And I decided when my first child was born that whatever may happen in his future, he is going to have me in his head singing the doxology, praying blessings over him, teaching him what to think about Israel and Gaza, as well as to believe in the Lord Jesus, to repent, to love his wife and his kids, and to understand the values that the Bible gives us. And I can't help but think of Genesis 17, where we see the covenantal promise given to Abraham. And what we find out in that passage is that this is the normative pattern for, what us Presbyterians like to call covenantal succession, what normal people say passing the faith to the next generation looks like. And I just decided a long time ago that it would be a nightmare for me to be a successful military officer, to have a successful church, to be a well-known writer, and to have my wife hate me or my kids not want to talk to me. If I could choose to be an utter failure and outside of the house, but have a wife and kids who love me till the day I die, that's victory as far as I'm concerned. Now, I don't think that I don't want that to happen. Obviously, I want to be a good father and a good husband, mm-hmm. as well as a good pastor and a good chaplain. I want to be able to leave an inheritance to my children's children. But if I only had to pick one, you pick the one at home first, because the picture painted with Abraham is that the covenantal sign is given to the next generation because the expectation, the normative pattern, is that the faith will go to the next generation. I remember having a conversation a while back, and I was just discussing, that whole process of moving the faith from one generation to the next. And the guy said something that stuck with me. He said, if Christians had never converted a single person outside of their family, but had kept their children, America would be a very different place. Right? Now, obviously, we share the gospel with our neighbors and everybody. But if we had simply just kept our kids, then the world would look very different. And we're failing in that regard. And so I thought to myself, where can I have the biggest impact in my own personal life? And I said, it has to start with my family.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's where God, well, the principle really is closeness to you is you have an impact with. You can impact people that are further away, but you don't have the lasting close impact as you do as those close to you. And yet, I think I'll just be honest, it's a temptation to want to reverse that. How do you overcome that? So, because like, do you understand what I'm saying? There's this temptation, like, I got to put all my attention outward, outside of those close to me. A lot of it comes in these arguments and these things to the neglect of those close. Right? I remember it's kind of like, I think it was Chesterton that said that, like, there's people that love people or mankind, but they don't love a single individual.
Yeah, that's right.
And, that's what liberals do, but I think a lot of conservatives, we tend to do that as well, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a couple of things at work in what you described there. I mean, I totally agree that there is this temptation to want to go out and to try to impact out. And part of that is because I think there's two things at play. The first one is you don't have to have near the personal investment with people out there. If you write a blog and send it into the void, you don't ever have to be with somebody who takes your advice and are suffering as a result. But if you're a local church pastor, or if you are at home and you are with your children, or you with your parishioner who's going through a crisis, right? Something terrible has happened. You don't have to see the tears of the people who read your blog on the other side of the world. And so it's harder. Being in person, being close to people is harder. I regularly like to remind people that, in my own opinion, the hardest commandment that we are given by God to keep is to love one another as Christ loved us. It's hard to do. It's hard to do because people on the other side of the world don't betray you. People on the other side of the world don't say rude things to you. People on the other side of the world, I mean, they might, but you can just ignore them, right? The reality is the nitty-gritty of day-to-day life is done face-to-face. And I mean, that really is a perfect transition point to the second thing that I said, which is you have to focus locally. And I think, you know, I said there were two things at play. The first one was that it's hard locally. But the second thing that's going on is a lot of times people, they want to create this sort of mythical persona. Social media gives us the ability to create sort of a fictional person that we wish we were, that we're not in person, that we're not in real life, right? You never show the unflattering pictures on social media. You never put anything out there that is embarrassing. But when you are a pastor of a local church, they see you say dumb stuff. They see you trip when you're walking up to preach. They see you, right, like whatever it might be. They see you do embarrassing things, and you kind of have to look at them, and they go, "Ha, I caught you, Pastor." You know, one of the things that sometimes happens to us Presbyterians who don't mind an alcoholic drink every once in a while is that we will buy a bottle of wine and get caught by somebody at Kroger. And we have to go, oh, okay, you know. And I think it's just that face-to-face interaction that we sometimes recoil from. But here's the thing that I always want to remind folks. Those are the people that you impact the most. Yes, I'm perfectly fine with people listening to sermons from Vody Baucham and John Piper and these, you know, R.C. Sproul. They're phenomenal preachers. And so by all means, go listen to them. But you will be shaped theologically, culturally, and intellectually far more by your local pastor who you listen to, you know, 7,500 teachings a year, who is there to counsel you when things go wrong. And that's the people that you impact the most. That's the people you shape the most. One of the things that I'm really looking forward to in ministry is that moment where you marry a young couple, you baptize their young children, and then you marry that young child that you baptized. And you've just come full circle. And then when you finally do pass away and go to be with the Lord, that family impact is going to continue. And so it's in a sense part of God's natural design. When we were talking about family earlier, one of the sort of philosophical points that I try to remind people is here in the West, we've got this idea that the most basic piece of any culture is the individual. But biblically, that's not true. Biblically, it is the family. Our individual identity does not come together with a number of other individual identities to form a family. It is the family that then helps the individual identity emerge. I mean, think about it. Our family gives us our language, our last name, our genetics, our habits. The family is where the culture is built, and our individual identity comes out of that. And so it is part of God's natural design that we love the people that we are closest to, both in terms of family and in terms of community. But also, it's natural for us to be influenced by them. And I can't remember how long ago it was that I realized this, Joseph, but we influence them as well. And as I grow older, and as I gain a little bit more influence, and I gain a little bit more stature among the people that I live with, I recognize my influence is getting stronger, and I want to use that for godly purposes. I want to use that to make my community a little bit more of a God-glorifying place. I was asked, a number of times by people, why are you doing a church plant, BJ? What is it that's motivating you to do a church plant? There's a whole host of answers to that question. But probably the one that drives me the most is that probably like 2 or 3 years after I got here, I was driving through town and we have a couple of empty shops in, it looks like a typical old small town. It's got a couple of empty shops. We've got like a smoke shack. We've got like a pawn shop. We've got like a Dollar Tree that took over the old video store. And I just thought, this is what my kids are going to grow up in. This is what my kids are going to live in when they get older. And I want to do something to make it better. I want to do something to make it a more God-glorifying place. And so I planted a flag and decided, you know what? Let's see if anybody else is with me. And it's been very encouraging, Joseph, to see that happen. But I think that this part of the reason that I'm driven by that is because it's just the way God has designed us to live. We influence mm-hmm. people closest to us because we spend more time with them. I think about that whole like return on investment. Maybe I'll persuade somebody, of my opinion about Israel and Gaza on the internet. Maybe I will. But the reality is, I don't know how much that's going to change their life. But if I persuaded a young college sophomore that he really does need to step up and be, as your podcast says, a patriarch, to adopt the posture that says, I'm going to be a godly husband and father. I'm going to lead my family well, regardless of what the culture says. Man, we're starting to make an impact now, because that's not just going to impact him. That's going to impact his wife. That's going to impact his kids. It's going to impact his grandkids. And that's an effect that I would love to see happen. And, I think that this is one of the reasons that our enemies who advocate for feminism, who advocate for Marxism, who hate the Christian church, go after the family and go after local communities. They want us to be a bag of greasy BBs that all just hang out together. But when you build from the family up and the community out, and you start building these kinds of things, you become resilient in a way that statists and, the types of leftists that we're against don't want us to have, because then they can't control us. And I'll get off my platform on that point, but that's one of the reasons I focused so locally, because I realized, Listen, man, I'm not going to change this. We're not going to turn the Titanic around at this point, but I can turn around Xenia, Ohio.
Exactly. You can see everything Joe Biden's doing and all that stuff. You need to be informed and all that stuff. But if I can't influence my own family, my own church, like what influence I'm going to have on him or anything else? So, all right. So you said family first, then local focus. I'm assuming your church would fall under that. And then you said institutions over popularity. So what do you mean by that?
What I primarily mean by that is we live in a day and age of social media influencers, and social media influencers, I'm not sure that you can come up with a less lasting way of influencing the world. As soon as pop culture just gets bored with you, you don't mean squat. Even if you become really famous, as soon as you die, if you haven't left anything behind, then it's going to go away. Whereas if you start building institutions, you create a legacy that will go well beyond your years. Sort of connecting it to the previous point, a lot of the focus on localism came out of the conferences that Pastor Foster put on in Batavia, the county before country. But one of the things that I love that he's doing is that he's not simply trying to build an online platform. In many ways, he has basically given up the conference circuit that he could pursue in order to build a local church and in order to build local planted churches in this area. he's focusing on institutions. And one of the reasons I decided to partner with him is because I think that's going to go way farther than anything any one man could do. And I don't have near the charisma of half the preachers that are on the internet these days. I don't pretend to have that kind of charisma. So I couldn't build a popular platform if I wanted to. But the fact of the matter is, if I begin to participate in institutions, that's where things will go really far. And I'll tell you where I got a lot of that from County Before Country, but it really started to sink in even before that when I was a public school teacher. I was a public school teacher in Norfolk, Virginia. I was stationed down there with the Air Force. And as a National Guardsman, you have a civilian job and you work part-time for the military. And my full-time job was as a public teacher. And here I am, a short, chubby white boy from Southern Ohio, and I'm in this super urban context. It's like 65% black. It's like 20% Hispanic, and then a mix of, you know, Asian and white and everything else. So I'm a minority there. And it was just a really interesting experience. But here's what I found out. I was able to plug in as an English teacher. I have an English degree, and I was teaching English. And I was able to impact these kids without having to build anything. I just showed up with an English degree and they needed a teacher. And so here you go. And I spent 6 years teaching them how to read Shakespeare and how to write. I spent an awful lot of time talking about the Bible, even though I was warned that I need to back off. I didn't heed that. I just ignored them. It was a public school. So, And I'm not a fan of the public school. I think the public school is a disaster. I think it has been the mechanism whereby so much of leftist and secular thought has taken our kids from us. And what that speaks to is the power of institution. What that speaks to is the power of an organization being able to propagate itself in powerful ways. Because what an institution does is it allows for specialization. It you don't have to do all things for all people. I just was frankly a kid that liked to read. I enjoyed good literature. I enjoyed reading some Shakespeare and some Dostoevsky and some Steinbeck. I like poetry. And I got to spend time influencing the next generation. And because I was a faithful Christian, I was able to use that platform in ways to grow the kingdom, to help them to learn how to think more deeply. And that opportunity would not have been given to me without the institution of the public school. And so what I want to encourage folks to do is to say, okay, how can we, if we're going to think generationally, if we're going to think in terms of, you know, families passing the faith on to the next generation, what can we be building in terms of our communities that will live past us? Mm-hmm. And I think I'll just point to four different things. I think planting churches is going to be crucial. I think building schools has to be a part of this. I think building publishing houses, or maybe a better word would be like content platforms, right? Where we're able to record for in perpetuity into future generations content that they can then consume. But then also, I think community businesses are a part of this. This is something that a lot of evangelicals have a hard time with. Our sort of latent Gnosticism gets in our way, and we think earning money or building things for profit is somehow ungodly. But the reality is you can have a huge influence on community if you build a business. You can have a huge influence on your family if you build a business. You can have a huge you want to know how to get the local mayor's attention? Show up and say, hey, I'm going to bring 20 jobs to your city, right? You will have an impact. And so if we can learn how to do that, it begins a perpetuating cycle. It becomes a process of moving along. And
well, let me ask you, sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you here.
Nope.
But I'm going to play devil's advocate. So, okay.
By all means, go for it.
Well, it's twofold. Okay. We keep building stuff. It keeps getting destroyed, getting taken over. So I don't know if you've ever heard that argument, right? So how do we maintain institutions? That could be a whole podcast. Two, what about the guy that's, he's not a church planner, he's not going to build an institution. He's not going to be the guy to start it. what instruction do you give him in regards to this principle? Because I agree with the principle. So I guess two questions you can run with. How do we, and I think they can be interrelated, which is why I bring them up, because there's starting institutions and then there's preserving them or serving them, giving yourself to building other stuff that other people have started up. So anyways, those are my questions. Take off with them if you can.
Copy that. So the first question, I'm a Presbyterian and our history is one of building awesome institutions and then handing them off to our enemies.
Yep.
We do. We hand them off to, I mean, we built Princeton and now Princeton is destroying us in some ways. We built so much of American Christianity and now American Christianity is turned on us. So I listen, the observation is absolutely correct. But I would just say this. The institutions are only as good as the culture around them. And the culture around them is only as good as the families that built those cultures. So what's the solution? The bad news is it's going to take 50 years or 100 years. The good news is we have the answer. We teach young men to be godly patriarchs, to go have a herd of children, to make a bundle of money, to disciple our kids, to be faithful to the local church, and to go build businesses. And to follow into your second question, what if I'm not the leader? What if I'm not the church planter or the business starter? The fact of the matter is, just pure numbers in any institution, you're going to have a small number of leaders and you're going to have a large number of participants. So I didn't start the public schools, but you know what I did? I went and became a teacher and I worked very hard to do what I could to influence it in a godly way. Presently, I'm in the United States Air Force. There are many things you could say good about the United States Air Force, but is it a godly, God-fearing, Christ-honoring organization? Not even by a long shot. So what am I doing? I'm trying to be salt and light in a dark place. And it takes some shrewdness because the current environment that we find ourselves in is we want to take godly salt and light and go get into ungodly organizations, or we want to go start afresh organizations that we can make godly. Now, a lot of folks will take the black pill route and say, well, you can go plant a church, but as soon as you die and hand it off, then somebody else is going to just go make it liberal. Maybe. But the reality is we have to do what's in front of us with the time that we're given. And I am convinced that if we can have a generation of young men who do lead their families well, that we will have less of a concern about that. It will always be a concern. I mean, this is, you're in war. We're in a cultural, spiritual war. Welcome. You have to fight. That's just the reality of it. Get after it. So I understand the temptation to black pill, but one of the things that they teach us very clearly in the military is that, you know, courageous men face down wickedness. They don't run from it. And that's what I want to challenge all of those who are tempted in that direction to do. Yes, it's a disaster out there. But here's what I always like to tell folks. Being a pastor, being a minister, being somebody who is trying to be godly salt and light is like being a roofer after a tornado. I mean, we got work everywhere. And you can either say, oh, this project is too big, or you can say, well, let's get started. And I'm just going to encourage y'all, get after it. Let's get moving.
Yep. All right. Well, you had two more principles. If we can get through those somewhat quickly, I don't want to take all your time here, but you're doing, this is very good. But, fight today's battles. So you're family first, local focused, institutions over popularity, but fight today's battles. What do you mean? Like talk about Roman Catholicism all the time and justification by faith and, is that what you mean?
maybe a better way to answer this is to start with what I don't mean.
Okay.
As pastors and ministers, it is our job to teach the whole counsel of the Word of God. As fathers, it is our job to pass the entirety of the faith to the degree that we are able onto our children. And so I don't want us to think that, you know, oh, we can't talk about Roman Catholicism because it's not, you know, the issue of the day, or we can't talk about, you know, whatever it might be. But there is a temptation among two groups, really. The first group is sort of the generic American evangelicals who are squishy, big Eva types, but also among really hardcore reformed intellectual types, where we basically will hide behind various different topics in order to avoid talking about what potentially is going to cause a stir. And so, you know, in the hardcore reformed world, we run into this a lot where, you know, we're talking about head coverings or the church calendar, or we're talking about various different things that, you know, happened a long time ago. And I don't mean to suggest that we shouldn't ever talk about those things. They do matter, but they're not the issue that's being attacked today. And in Big Eva churches, what you end up running into is they run the opposite way, where it's like, well, we want to be relevant and we want to be practical and we want to be. And so all they ever talk about is like six ways to make your, you know, family life better or whatever. And again, like, sure, we need to talk about family life. We need to talk about raising kids and marriage and, you know, how to avoid anxiety and stuff like that. But the fact of the matter is, right now, what is stealing our next generation is questions about sexuality, questions about gender, questions about the big umbrella term is anthropology. What does it mean to be a human? Think of any topic right now that would get you potentially canceled, right? If you talk about, you know, trannies, if you talk about homosexuality, if you talk about marriage, if you talk about gender roles, if you talk about education, if you have strong opinions about homeschooling or sex ed, if you talk about medical stuff, right, that'll get you canceled too in the days of COVID. All of these, to one degree or another, are related to the question of what does it mean to be a human being? What is a human and what is a human for? And when you as a Christian start answering that question, you will say, we're made in the image of God. Therefore, you can't destroy them in the womb. You are made male and female. Therefore, you have different natures. You sin differently. And when you are in a marriage, you have to work differently. You play different roles. And when you discipline a child, humans are innately sinful, therefore you have to use corporal punishment. You have to use it in a godly way, but you have to use it. And all of those, and again, one way or another, connect back to the question of, you know, who are we as humans? And the reason for that is because, you know, long ago we lost the battle of Darwinism, creation and evolution. We are all Darwinists now. We all treat each other, unfortunately, like we're just animals. Mm-hmm. And that the downstream effects of all of this are that we have forgotten who we are and what we are supposed to be doing. That's just the reality. This is the reason that socialism has been able to gain such a foothold in our culture is because people forgot that we were created to work, right? The idea here is we need to escape work and we just need to be able to lounge around at the expense of the government. And the reality is like, no, your life only has meaning if you're being productive and fruitful. You get up every day and go accomplish something. So that's what I'm talking about, is fighting today's battle is recognizing where the enemy is fighting the most. And, you know, we have in the Air Force and the military as a whole, right? The wars of the Middle East are basically non-existent now, right? We're not involved in them. So we need to figure out how to move on. We need to figure out where the next front is. We need to learn how to modernize our military. And in many ways, we need to learn how to do that as well. I know there's a quote from Luther that floats around the internet, or it's supposedly from Luther. I don't know if he actually said it. There's a lot of fake Luther quotes out there.
Maybe Abraham Lincoln, I think.
But the point he tried to say is, if you are faithful, I think the quote is something like, if you are faithful to the Christian faith at every point, except that one that Satan is attacking, then you are not a faithful follower of Christ. Mm-hmm. And that's a paraphrase, of course, but it, you know, and again, I don't think Luther said it, but the principle is correct. We need to be able to firm up where this thing is being attacked. And part of pastoral ministry is having enough cultural awareness to see where the attack is happening.
Well, I think you could, so you can take this and run with it. Even I agree with everything you've said. These are the big principles, but then this principle applies locally. So as a pastor, when I preach, do I preach and confront the sins of the people in my congregation? Right. So that's fighting today's battles with the people there. You can take the same principle with your family. Are you willing to talk to and discuss the things your family's actually engaged in? Right, you've got to do these broader wars, I believe, about gender and all that stuff, sexuality, with your children all the time, I think. But specifically, do you engage the battle right in front of you? And that takes you have to see.
Yeah.
You have to see what you see. And we specialize in not seeing what we see. We specialize in, oh, if I see this and I think it is what I think it is, oh, that's work I don't want to do. So let me pretend like that doesn't exist and focus on the battles where they're not at. Right. So I really appreciated fighting today's battles, but fighting the battles where they're at in front of you, to the specific people that God's given you.
Amen.
All right. And then your last principle then here, I think is important as well, which is you deal with the most extreme things first, right?
Yes, that's
You deal with the little skinny thing, like the somebody told me he called it the skinny branches of theology. I had a friend that would call it that, right? The most important thing is to deal with head coverings and those things. And then you get to the gospel. No, actually, your principle is fundamentals first. So explain that. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I think your sort of closing comment on point four really is a perfect feeder into this, which is you have to deal with the most important things in front of you first. I remember really coming into my own in my faith during college. A little bit post college. And at the time I graduated college in 2003, I remember just seeing eschatology conferences all over the place. Now, I know that this was going on well before I discovered it, but the reality was, I mean, everybody had a prediction of when Jesus was coming. Y2K was a huge thing, you know, in 99. And I remember like reading some of this, and I remember thinking to myself, like, okay, cool. Like, I hadn't developed an eschatology at that point, so I didn't know what I believed about it. But I kind of walked away thinking, like, okay, what does that have to do with me? Like, I kept feeling a little bit like, okay, why does this matter? And as I got into pastoral ministry, one of the other things that I began to notice is a very large gap between the types of conversations that happen online and the concerns that are raised online versus what I was seeing in my own local church. For instance, nobody came into my office and said, "Pastor BJ, what do you think about the Jewish question?" Now, listen, if your church is in Israel and you are dealing with Jews on a day-to-day basis, okay, fine. You're going to deal with that in a way that it's just not important to me, right? Because when people came into my office, they were saying, "Hey, my husband won't come home after work. He prefers to go drinking. My wife hasn't made love to me in, 6 months. My kids won't listen to me and my teenager's looking at porn." These were the concerns that were front and center for me. And so what I realized is I do have a responsibility as a pastor to teach the whole counsel of God. But I also don't feel the need to persuade everybody about my view of the Nephilim. Right? If half my congregation in my previous call wouldn't even have known what that word meant. Is it wrong to write a book about the Nephilim? No, by all means, go listen to your podcast. Haunted Cosmos is awesome. So go listen to it.
It's cool.
But the reality is day-to-day ministry life is much more gritty. You know, if you've got somebody who's dealing with drug addiction or alcoholism or something like that, you're going to need to be able to speak to that issue. One of the reasons I love being a chaplain is it keeps me a little bit more grounded, keeps me out of the Reformed echo chamber a little bit. I'm a Reformed guy. I love the Reformed world. They're my people. But man, they have a habit of being able to get lost in the weeds about things when day-to-day ministry life is shouting at them for much more important things. And so what do I mean by fundamentals first? If you have a congregation that doesn't understand basic soteriology, teach them how to understand their relationship with Christ. Teach them about baptism and the Lord's Supper. Teach them about the Sabbath and attending the necessity of attending worship. Teach them how to catechize their children. Teach them how to love their wives as Christ loved the church. Teach the women how to be submissive and respectful to their husbands in a way that's going to make the home a glorious place. And what I have found is if you get those parts correct, then the other stuff actually comes much more easily. You can sit around with a cigar and a sip of bourbon and have a good old discussion about head coverings or whatever it might be. But the more important issues are the ones that affect our day-to-day lives in a way that produces that greater fruit. The question I always ask myself is, if the fruits of the Spirit are love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control, is what I am doing producing that? And I love being able to have that practical outcome-driven thinking because the Bible gives it to us. Paul says, this is how we will know that you have the Spirit. You have the Spirit if your life is characterized by these kinds of things. And if you have perfect eschatology and you've convinced everybody about your view of the covenant, but they don't have those fruits of the Spirit, then guys, we're missing something. If your home is filled with strife and your kids just are not being obedient and you're getting a lot of back talk, then maybe let's not have another discussion about, you know, whatever. Let's maybe figure out the heart of the issue. And so that's kind of where I'm at, is like, let's not degrade people for having these conversations, but let's definitely say, hey, let's make sure we have the more important things in place first.
Hey, brother, this has been, I think, very encouraging and very helpful, just to sober us up, to remind us of the work that we have in front of us and to prioritize, to be engaged in where we can make an impact and the manner in doing so. I found your post very encouraging, and I'm convicted as I listen to this because I'm tempted to be out and doing the stuff that don't matter. I don't remember whoever said this. It was something like, I don't want to be good at accomplishing things that don't matter.
Amen to that.
Rather. I appreciate your time. If our listeners had wanted to get a hold of you, they had any questions about this, where would be a good way for them to get a hold of you?
Sure thing. Probably the only social media that I have is on Facebook. So BJ Newman, and you'll see, my profile there. It's all pretty much public. So feel free to reach out to me there. Joseph, let me just add one quick final word before we go. Mm-hmm. I do have a lot of folks who will come to me and say, hey, BJ, you put this thing forward. I'm convicted, but I'm way off the base. What do I do? And I just want to encourage folks, like, when we say these kinds of things, our goal is to challenge you to take what you've got in front of you and just get moving in the right direction. If you've been chasing silliness for weeks and weeks, the best thing you can do is just start getting at it. There's no perfect time to start. Just wake up tomorrow morning and make it happen. But the key feature to all of it, and this is something that I try to emphasize throughout all of my ministries, is the Bible tells us that the joy of the Lord is our strength. And the thing that we really need to do is to be able to just have joy in the fight, The fight is a dark one. The culture war is a terrible one. But if we have joy when we're doing it, it makes all the difference in the world. And it will make our home life better, our local ministries better. It will help us build institutions better. And so smile, raise a glass, and remember, the joy of the Lord is our strength.